Public Safety Finance Committee will come to order. We have four bills up today. The first bill we will take up is House File 767, Representative Dominguez. Welcome, Representative Dominguez.
Thank you, Chair.
Please present your bill and introduce, and then you can have your testifiers introduce themselves on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. This is House File 767. That's relating to public safety and appropriating money for an offender's reentry pilot project. With that, I'm going to turn it over so we can have the testifiers testify. I know we're going to have some time here, but I want the testifiers to really explain the program to you. So,
very good.
With that, Mr. Chair, I'm going to have the first testifier, Mr. Cole, introduce himself.
Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Ray Cole, President and CEO of Midwest Challenge. Also with me today is Lou Ann Kelly, Vice President of Midwest Challenge. Cheryl Cabot, the Executive Director of Central Neighborhood Weedency, and Kelly Peters, who is a former offender and current staff member at Midwest Challenge. And I'd like to thank you for carrying this bill forward and enhancing this very important work. You have a packet of information in front of you, and the first page is results of a survey that we did with our current residents. And we have a work release program. We have about 25 men in our houses that are in transition from prison. And so we asked them, what are the biggest obstacles of transitioning back to society, and what are the areas they need most help with? And so that first page kind of hits on that. The second page is titled Midwest Challenge and the Partnership Reentry Pilot. And I'm going to kind of go right down that page there. And I want to assure you we're not going to go through that whole packet now, but just the first couple pages. Midwest Challenge has been working with those struggling with addiction since 1972. In 2001, we entered the offender reentry world by starting a reentry program. I want to share with you an experience I had that really was a paradigm shift for me. I remember bringing all the men together into the house and saying, statistics tell me that 70% of you will be back in prison within 3 years. What are you going to do to make sure you're one of the 30% that does not go back? And there was dead silence, not an argument, not an excuse, nothing. And that just kind of startled me. And afterwards, one of the men pulled me aside and said, Ray, do you really think any of us can change? He said, this is all we've known. This is all we've ever done. And what I heard in that was hopelessness. And that is something that I've really seen over the years, over and over, and one of the major obstacles that we are seeking to address. And from that point on, our whole programming took a shift and a change, and that every element of programming had to have in it that element of hope. You can change. You can be different. You can start a new life today. And we've been very successful. If you look down the page, you'll see in 2005 our statistics there that only 28% of the men that graduated from our program went back to prison. Now the downside, that's the positive side, 28%. The downside of that is only 56% of those that started our program graduated. And so when we look at that, you know, what are the obstacles? Why is this happening? And from the survey, you see the major obstacle is employment. And I can tell you in the 6 years we've been doing this, very, very seldom have I ever sent somebody back to prison because they didn't have a job. But many, many, many times guys have messed up because of the constant rejection, the disappointment, the resentment, the hurt, the anger that is the result of not being able to find work. This bill will enable us to hire a reentry specialist, someone that will focus on not only that piece but several other pieces. But the big thing is to walk beside that offender as they go through the ups and downs, the hurts, the pains, the rejections, and those pieces. There'll also be a conduit, a connection to our reentry panel, and that's the real exciting part. And you'll see on that bottom half of the second page, top of the third, the different people we have on that panel from areas like the Department of Corrections. We've got people from housing, from employment. And so there you have the village helping out and helping to help these guys make it through. We believe this bill will not only serve to raise our graduation rate, but also lower the recidivism rate and save thousands of dollars. But most important, it will save lives. And this is just a start. You know, as we do this reentry pilot, this will be something we'll be able to expand and then be copied in other communities in other areas. So we're very excited about that. Now, Mr. Chair, I would respectfully ask that I turn over and recognize Luann Kelly, the Vice President of Midwest Challenge.
Welcome, Ms. Kelly. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Luann Kelly. I'm Vice President of Administration at Midwest Challenge.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to briefly explain why this appropriation of $200,000 per year is so important to our reentry pilot program. The funding through this bill would be invaluable in providing a full-fledged pilot program. Our draft discussions on the budget have included a full-time employee who would follow up with clients to make sure that they're networked with the necessary resources they need. In addition, life skill classes would be provided to help clients with issues such as relapse prevention, budgeting, and employment. Other costs would be office setup, including internet access, computers, and phones. This funding would also allow us to strengthen and expand mentor and volunteer recruitment and training, as well as develop a larger network of felony-friendly employers. We would be able to expand support to our clients with bus passes to use as they are job searching, legal help, mental health counseling, job training software, and skill evaluation. Please keep in mind that this isn't something we plan to come back to again and again. This is a one-time request. By the end of the two-year period, we plan to have ongoing funding secured so we can continue our reentry program. And now I would like to introduce Kelly Peters.
Excuse me one second. Representative Smith, do you want to ask a question now or do you want to wait till everyone?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to wait till the end, but there are questions.
Who was next? Please state your name for the record.
My name is Kelly Peters, and I'm a caseworker at Midwest Challenge and an ex-offender. I exited prison in 1998, and at the time that I exited prison, some of the biggest challenges that faced me were, how do I answer the question, did you have a felony conviction or have you had a previous felony conviction? How could I communicate in an interview that in a way that would help me get the job? That was a real challenge. Getting around, learning how to get around the cities, learning the bus system, learning where to access bus passes was quite a challenge for me. It took a little while to sort those things out, and at that time those particular resources weren't very available. I struggled with the fear of rejection, knowing that I would apply for a job or I would apply for a resource or a service and there was some possibility that I'd be turned down simply because of choices that I made in the past, and not that those choices were bad, they were, but I wanted to do something different, and I was really afraid of what might come my way, and so that was the hardest part, I think, for me at that time. I had some skills and was able to put those to work for me and eventually discover what I needed. As a caseworker at Midwest Challenge, that fear and that confusion is evident to me every day. I work with individuals on a regular basis that are struggling with these same things. And while I have some experience at getting through those things and working through those things, I'm not trained as a job placement counselor. I'm not trained in all of the things that these men really need help in. I mean, I can work with them on a spiritual level. I can work with them on an emotional level and connect with them there. But I see my responsibilities very limited in going past that. And I believe that this bill would allow us to hire an individual that could work much more closely with them, much more in depth on these specific issues, and carry them a great deal further, and allow me the time to work with them on other significant issues like their spiritual development and their emotional development, and recognizing their responsibilities in the community.
Thank you for your testimony.
We have one more testifier.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Cheryl Cabot. I'm the Central Weed and Seed Executive Director. And we are planning partners in this pilot project with Midwest Challenge. The last time I had the pleasure of sitting before this committee and testifying was in 1996, when the House and the Senate were considering an appropriation to start four pilot projects, weed and seed pilot projects for the state of Minnesota, of which the Central Neighborhood ended up being one. And that appropriation was $611,000 for the four sites. The Central Weed and Seed site over the past 11 years has leveraged nearly $7 million out of that, and never came back to the state for additional appropriations beyond that. Next month, the Central Weed and Seed site will be recognized nationally as a best practices weed and seed site, all because of something that began at a state level and has never been duplicated in another state since, and yet no other state has ever had as much success with their weed and seed sites as Minnesota has. I like to think that as a premier weed and seed site, we know how to pick them. We know what kinds of things to get involved with and what kinds of things stand a best chance of success and a best chance of moving forward and being able to be duplicated throughout the state in other communities, whether they're large and small, large or small. And I think that this particular reentry project is just exactly that. The way that we are modeling this, it would work for offenders that are juvenile offenders. It would work for offenders that are female offenders. It will work for offenders that are male offenders, and can be easily duplicated. And once we get through the pilot project process and are able to evaluate it, we believe that it will be able to be done for a pretty minimal cost. So I thank you for your time. I thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We have questions. Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I have a question for the author and then a few nuts and bolts question for Mr. Cole. On the bill itself, the bill refers to a community-based nonprofit organization which would be selected by the commissioner. Of the author, we've heard from Midwest Challenge. Are you anticipating that they be the organization that's going to be selected under this bill should it become law?
Representative Dominguez.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I didn't put that in perspective, but it could be Midwest Challenge. It could be Weed and Seed.
Oh, Mr.
Representative
Chairman.
Representative Smith.
Where in the bill does it specify or as to how the commissioner would pick the organization?
Dominguez.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I would hope that we could have that conversation with the commissioner.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it might make sense to put it in the bill as to how that organization will be selected. Mr. Cole, just a few questions of you. Remind me of the background of Midwest Challenge. I see you've been in operation since 1972. That's 34 years. Are you a corporation, or how are you formed?
We're by 123 nonprofit. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
You have to go through this chair. We're taping this. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We are a incorporation. We're a 501c3 nonprofit. And like you said, we've been in existence since 1972. And we started out working primarily in the areas of addiction and recovery. And like you said, in 2001, we started our work release program. And we still do, we have two houses, or another house that we work with, addiction recovery, in the two houses of work release.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Smith, what salary do you draw yearly as President of Midwest Challenge?
Mr. Cole.
$45,000.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Cole.
Representative Smith.
The handout that you've passed suggests that of that $200,000 per year, you have the numbers broken down to the dollar, $45,000 for reentry specialists. Do you anticipate hiring, and you list a staff of 10, do you anticipate then hiring an 11th person for that amount of money?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Mr. Chairman, Mr.
Smith.
You list $57,550 for administration of the project. Would you describe for me what kinds of expenses come in under the word administration of the project?
Mr. Cole.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask my Leanne Kelly to help with this. Is that
sure? Ms. Kelly.
Mr. Chair, well, I'm going first set up a setup with phone lines, computers, internet access so they can get on the internet and look for jobs. We want to invest in software that would help with skill evaluation with each client. Then you've got the ongoing costs of phone service and things like that and office supplies. Then there would be accounting systems that would have to be in place to oversee the the financial end of it. There would also the program side of it with our life skill classes, trying to expand and find more employers who would hire guys who have felonies on their records. Again, the expansion of our mentoring and volunteer programs so we could get more people involved with working with the guys, people in the community.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Kelly, since you're answering that, it also lists $97,450 a year for travel and other expenses. You've identified some expenses.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of travel, where are you traveling, and what kind of other expenses would there be?
Okay. Ms. Kelly.
Mr. Chair, some of the program expenses are in that category that I mentioned earlier as far as the actual hands-on working with the guys. Then we also have the bus passes for the guys, phone cards, different things like that that would help them. as far as travel goes, we're thinking that this person would probably want to get further training if there's conferences to go to, like there's a conference in Chicago for the legal aspects of offender reentry. So we wanted to build in some dollars to send this new staff person to more training.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Cole, and maybe Ms. Kelly, I see in your sheet information that you say that you anticipate that the program would be refined during the first 2 years and the cost would decrease. You also listed some startup costs. I'm having a little trouble understanding, if you've been in operation for 34 years, why there would be any startup costs and why you wouldn't already have a handle on how this program would be worked so that there wouldn't be a need to decrease the cost. I don't know if that's a very clearly stated question, but I'm having trouble understanding how you've been in business for 34 years and you're anticipating a reduction in costs as you get up and running.
Mr. Chair, right now we do not have any office space for this person. This is an extra position, and so part of that is setting up an office, putting in the phones and all this type of thing, which would be a first time. The other piece to that is that no one that I know of has done this. This is a totally new. Generally, what we've done in work release and transitioning is housing. And this is another piece to that, to actually walk through the process with them, going beyond just housing them and beyond just controlling where they're going. A lot of our program is accountability, knowing where they're going, and this person is also going to go through that. And also connecting, you know, like I said, to the reentry panel. So it's a new area that we're delving into.
Mr. Chairman, I have just one last question. When the report comes back in 3 years, in 2010, you right now are showing out of 50 graduates, 14 have reoffended, or a 28% recidivism rate. If after 2 years of your program, that 28% is not less, would it be safe to conclude that this $400,000 was not well spent, if that occurs?
Mr. Cole?
Yes, I would agree with that.
No further questions.
Representative Biscombs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, and a follow-up to a question asked earlier by Representative Smith. Representative Dominguez, I believe, and staff can correct me if I'm wrong, but the way this bill is written, the commissioner would have to put out an RFP for whoever receives this funding. And I don't know if, you know, it's your desire to leave it that wide open, because, of course, any organization could put in an RFP. So I do have a concern about that as this moves forward. And if there is a program that you think is worthy, you probably want to get it into the bill. The other question I have, Mr. Chairman, Representative Dominguez, is on page 2, line 13. And it's the report back to the legislature. Representative Dominguez, if this program is a successful program and you do see the recidivism rate drop because of the success of this program, then I believe that would have some big policy implications on criminal justice. And I think that's the intent of the pilot program is on the policy side. And yet, you're very specific about where the report should go, and that is to the chairs and ranking minority members who have jurisdiction over criminal justice funding. Right? And so there is no report actually being specified to go to the policy chairs. So I'm wondering, Representative Dominguez, if you would consider it a friendly amendment to simply delete the word funding. And now the report, it's already been generated, but it would ensure that the report go to both the finance and the policy chairs.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Dominguez.
In answer to Representative's question, I have no problem with that.
Representative Biscombs, do you want to make the amendment?
Mr. Chair, I'd move that on line 2.13, after the word justice, the word funding be stricken.
Representative Biscombs moves on line 13 that the word funding be stricken. Does anyone understand the amendment? Is there any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Any further questions, Representative Biscombs? Representative Dominguez or Mr. Coles, the current Midwest Challenge Reentry Program says that all participants must participate in Bible study and house meetings and become active in practicing their faith. How is that? Give me some comfort there about how this will work if someone is a non-Christian and wanted to participate in this in your program.
Mr. Chair, first of all, let me make clear too that this position, the individual and the reentry specialist would not be involved in any Bible studies or prayer or that type of thing. Their position would be separate from that. When we, as far as clients coming in, we tell them in the beginning that we're a faith-based organization and this is part of our programming. And so in this part of that, that those that come in, we do ask that they participate in all of our programming. Don't have to convert or anything like that, but to be able to participate in all our house meetings and all the stuff that goes involved with our programming.
Any questions? Representative Eastland.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Maybe it's a little bit
piggyback off your question, on the bill on page 1, line 18, it says, starts with, the organization shall meet with offenders before the release from prison to develop a holistic plan for successful reintegration. How are offenders or prisoners selected? What's the selection process? How do you identify the ones that you're going to be talking to and promoting the program to?
Mr. Carlson.
Sure, Chair. What we do right now, and again, this pilot project will grow, but those that qualify for work release through the Department of Corrections then can apply to any of the different programs. And if they apply to Midwest Challenge, and then we interview them, let them know what our program's like, what you're looking for, and if it's a fit, you know, then we set up a date when they would actually come in. And it's kind of a partnership between us and Department of Corrections.
All right, then if there's no further questions, the Representative Dominguez moves House File 767, and the Chair will lay House File 767 as amended over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you all for your testimony, and Representative Dominguez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Well, Representative Paymar is getting organized. We have had a quorum here for a while, so would somebody like to move to approve the minutes of March 14th and March 15th?
I will. So move.
Motion by Haas. Are there any corrections or additions? Anybody notice? If not, all in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
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 Opposed? Carried. Representative Paymar, you may proceed on House File 1823.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move 1823. And House File 1823, some of you have already heard this bill in the Policy Committee, but I'd like to go over some of the fiscal implications of the bill. As I stated before, this bill would allow for the Department of Corrections to contract with a program, a reentry program, that would participate in a five-year demonstration project designed to apply best practices to improve and promote the recovery and success of high-risk adults who frequently use costly public services such as emergency rooms, treatment programs, jails, prisons, and detoxification facilities, and combining an innovative management and government structure. As Mr. Carver talked about before, 90 to 95% of offenders in our prisons are going to get released, and 6,000 of them are released every year. And I think most of us on this committee believe that there should be punishment. We also believe that there should be rehabilitation, and that individuals who are incarcerated should have a chance to reintegrate into society. But in order to successfully reintegrate into society, you have to have job skills, you have to have a job, you have to have housing. You should be required to continue treatment, the treatment that you started while you're incarcerated, and be required to complete and participate in treatment post-incarceration. If we want to get a handle on the high rate of recidivism, we have to use best practices to start and participate in reentry projects. So with me today is our two individuals who talk more about the network, Steve Thomas and Lewis King.
Mr. Chair.
May I proceed, Mr. Thomas?
Committee members, I had the honor to present testimony back on January 31st regarding our innovation, so this morning I'll just offer a couple remarks as it relates to this legislation. I'm Steve Thomas. I'm the CEO of a new social enterprise called The Network, which is a type of demonstration program that will benefit from House File 1823. And I'm joined this morning, as Representative Paymar said, by Lewis King, who's one of the founding board members of our endeavor. The network's mission is to promote the recovery, resiliency, and prosperity of at-risk adults by creating communities of adults who are doing well. Our priority is to engage primarily African-American men. Our endeavor is driven by the belief that adults who enroll in the network have the potential to become somebody again, and the network's participants have inherent value and potential. By setting high expectations and providing access to the resources one needs to meet these expectations, adults in the network will be offered the opportunity to become contributing, productive, and respectful members of society. These are lofty aspirations, but we are building our enterprise on a base of sound research, proven strategies, and the collective experience of our founding partners. At the same time, we are crafting and testing some new and compelling innovations. First, we intend to rely on a range of existing community-based service providers to help meet our performance outcomes. We're not creating a new program or bureaucracy. Second, we are intent on working with government to use scarce funding much more effectively and to create a financing mechanism that currently does not exist. And third, we are launching a jobs enterprise that will fill a gap in the workforce development and job training market. And lastly, we intend to assemble our resources and these innovations into one cohesive enterprise. The network's unique and compelling value is based on the following distinctions. A comprehensive approach is informed by ongoing research and builds on proven practices and best models. Our performance-based earned income strategy will hold us and the adults we serve accountable for results. This enterprise is a highly cost-effective alternative to the proven inefficiencies and limited effectiveness of the current approach, which deals with only one aspect of people's lives. Our enterprise adds value to current programs by assembling providers into multidisciplinary service teams, and with these service teams we can achieve scale and have greater impact than any one program or provider. We are led by accomplished leaders and proven practitioners. This includes the North Point Health and Wellness Center, the African American Men Project, Medica, Summit Academy, OIC, Twin City Rise, the Family Housing Fund, and RSE. Collectively, they bring a track record of performance and credibility, especially when it comes to serving this high-risk adult population. And we are transforming the way creative, results-oriented enterprises are financed and purchased by government. House File 1823 authorizes a 5-year demonstration to launch and evaluate the performance of an innovation like the network. In addition, it appropriates $3.8 million for the upcoming biennium to launch and begin operating and evaluating an enterprise like the network in 2008. This is a daunting and creative venture. We have a lot to learn and we're charting new territory. But the strength and experience of our founding partners, coupled with critical support from the state and other public and private investors, will help ensure our success. Let me turn it over for a moment to my colleague, Lewis King.
You may proceed, Mr. King.
Mr. Chairman of the committee, I'm Lewis King, President and CEO of Summit Academy, OIC. We are a vocational training institute located in North Minneapolis. We believe that the best social service program in the world is a job. We joined the network as a founding member because we, a few years ago, launched an initiative entitled the 100 Hard Hats, which was aimed primarily at African-American men in North Minneapolis, recognizing that the demographics show tremendous opportunities in the future, and these individuals had not previously participated in construction in a meaningful way. Over the last 4 years of operating the program, 30% of the people coming into Summit have a criminal background. Their average wage at entry is $6,200 a year. We've been successful in having a 58% graduation rate with our individuals and a 75% placement rate, and the average wage upon placement is $25,000. Yet, the biggest challenge we had were twofold. A, many of them were unstable in the sense of housing. They did not have a place to live, and so that made it difficult for them to complete school. It's a 20-week program that we're conducting in partnership with Dunwoody. And some of our clients or students are actually in the workhouse while they attend summit during the day, and upon release they must get a job right away. And so we either had to invent jobs for them, because if you trying to get a construction job and you graduate in the winter, you've got to sit on the sidelines until the spring, or we'd have to find friendly organizations who would hire them. The network solves both of these problems for us because it provides stable housing for our folks living in a community where everyone is pursuing the same goals, and with its crew-based work teams will give them short-term employment while they're in school or waiting to be placed in a job that will launch their careers. We think this is a worthwhile venture, and as a result, Summit is a partner that actually pays into this system, and our benefits are derived by the success of our clients. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Poles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Probably for Mr. Thomas, and I'm looking at the budget summary that was just passed out, but as you know, I asked some questions in the policy committee about the budget and how you intend to use the money, and this is helpful, but maybe you could walk me through it. As I look at the bill, as I understand the bill, we're looking at providing the network with, and first of all, let me say I'm impressed by the program and by what you're trying to do, and I'm you know, vaguely familiar with Mr. King's organization, and certainly I think what you're trying to do in terms of bringing everybody together makes a lot of sense. But to be completely candid, I am concerned about the fact that, you know, we are spending approximately $30,000 a year right now on an individual who's incarcerated, and now we are looking to spend upwards of $19,000 a year per individual who is in this reentry program. So I have a couple of questions. Number one, can you help me understand what that $19,000 per year per individual is going to be used for? And that's the first question. I'll let you answer that before I ask the next one.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Yes, Mr. Thomas.
Representative Cole, thank you, and I'd be happy to do this. And the page that we just passed out, I've divided into our major, if you will, spending categories, and you can see out of that rate that you just described, most of it goes to housing assistance. And that, especially for this population, given their rental history, given their credit history, given that they have little resources up front. So one of our endeavors is to access market rate housing, and this financial assistance is interim. It's to assist them with making the initial down, or not down payment, but the initial 1 month's rent that's required up front, and then a declining rent subsidy for them over a period of time that we estimate could be from 9 to 18 months. But as their income increases, our rental assistance would decline. And by the way, I might add, most of this population is not eligible for federal rent subsidies. At least until recently, if you had a felony conviction, drug convictions, housing authorities, etc., a lot of subsidized housing in the community, this population can't access that housing. So that's a major expense. A second significant expense is related to the service teams that we want to assemble among the multiple providers that I mentioned earlier, and that is the role of this team leader. We have a ratio of about one team leader for every 20 participants, and their job is not only the coach and team leader for the 20 participants, but to also connect with the multiple service providers that we will have on the team. Another significant cost, and as you know, Representative Cole, we're in a business planning mode right now for this five-year demonstration, but insurance costs. We're modeling our jobs enterprise, for instance, on a program in New York. Their annual operating budget is $2.9 million. They spend $600,000 a year on insurance. This population, both from an employment side and just on a record side, is a risky population. So we're planning on close to half of those operating costs that I've listed. Close to half of that is just for insurance in the biennium coming up. And let me just, one other point, and then I'll be happy to entertain more of your questions about this. The 19,000 per participant rate that is in this biennium, I would encourage you to put this in the context of a 5-year demonstration. So for the first 2 years, that rate is going to be higher than the overall rate over the 5-year period, because we've got these costs, some of which are fixed, that are obviously going to go down as we enroll more participants. Our business planning, our target rate for serving these men once we're fully enrolled is 1,000 a month or 12,000 a year. And that's one of the things we want to be held accountable for if we're fortunate enough to take this demonstration beyond this funding in this biennium. So I hope that concept's understandable. If I'm not explaining it well, I apologize. But we understand that the per participant rate is going to be higher in the first 2 years. But over the course, by the time we have enrolled many more men, our target is to have this down to 12,000 a year.
Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With regard to the housing, you talked about first month's rent and then I'll describe it as a sliding scale support. I presume most of these men will be living in Minneapolis or St. Paul or in the Twin Cities area. What is the market rate for rent for a single bedroom apartment or a studio apartment?
Mr. Thomas. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Cole. The fair market rate for a studio, which is the ideal unit for us to find, is around $580, $585. A one bedroom is around $600, $625. So that's how we're sizing our finance. The participant has to pay at least $100 to $200 a month starting out, and our jobs enterprise helps them meet that commitment. But we expect that to decline. But again, if I may, that's why we're calling this a demonstration. No one's quite tried to, if you will, take on the market in this manner. I've got 25 years in experience in dealing with this high-risk population. Part of it includes building thousands of affordable housing units for this population. And that scenario, we can't create enough housing using that scenario and have an impact on this problem. So we're trying to size our financial assistance for housing so that we can take advantage of vacancies in the open market. How we'll do, that's one of the things we want to track.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Thomas, that brings me to my next question. This is a demonstration project, a 5-year pilot project, and I appreciate that you are establishing some benchmarks that we can evaluate your success by. Well, let's assume that 5 years out, you meet those benchmarks, or hopefully exceed those benchmarks. Then what? Will you be back here asking for more state money? Are you going to be in a position? Is it part of your plan to seek financial assistance from sources other than the state of Minnesota? What are those? Can you describe that for me? Because you know, one of the concerns I said early on, one of the issues I have is we're spending $30,000 a year on an inmate, and then we let them out, and clearly we want them to not end up back in the system. But do we need to spend, whether it's $19,000 or $12,000 a year, and for how long, and how long do we have to keep this? I mean, are we creating another government program that we're never going to be able to shut off? And maybe the answer is yes, and maybe that's okay. Mm-hmm. But help me understand that.
Mr. Thomas. Representative Damar.
Let me just take a quick stab at what my thinking is. And I think this is, for me anyway, I've served on this committee for 10 years, and this is sort of, I don't know if it's new thinking. Representative Eastland and others have been talking about this for years, and so has the Department of Corrections. And the Department of Corrections started MCOR, which I'm not sure exactly, Mr. Carver, how much they have in their budget now, but the governor's recommending, I think, $3 million on top of the appropriation for MCOR, which is sort of a consortium of people who are involved in reentry efforts, but they're just starting to get off the ground in the past 2 years and haven't significantly done a lot, I don't think. My personal feeling is that this is going to be an ongoing expense. I just believe that you can't send someone out the door with no money, no housing, no job skills, you know, and expect them to reintegrate back into society, they are going to reoffend. They are going to be moving back into my neighborhood, your neighborhood, throughout the metro area, and they're going to end up, not all of them, but a lot of them, I think, will reoffend if they don't have that kind of support, the discipline that a project like this could provide them, and become gainfully employed and reintegrate back into society. I just think it's going to be an ongoing expense that we should consider part of the Department of Corrections' base budget in the future. That's my feeling, but go ahead.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Thomas?
Representative Cole, to add to that, first of all, you had a question. As you know, we proposed a pay-for-performance structure in this bill. And one scenario we envision is that, well, it's not that we envision, that we have proposed is that we only get paid as we're meeting these benchmarks that are outlined in the bill, and that's on a monthly basis. Secondly, this is not a long-term subsidy. The maximum period of time, at least the way we've proposed it, that we could receive reimbursement for an eligible participant is 24 months. So this is not a long-term entitlement. Thirdly, 5 years from now, I would like this to be a transforming experience. Namely, if we're investing $100 million, and this isn't the right number, but if we're, for every $100 we're now investing in criminal justice, we can reduce that significantly. But we're still going to need to continue to invest, but this is a much better investment. So the sustainability for this product, if you will consist of redirected state money, but hopefully less state money, but still some state money. And, frankly, I think the counties would find this very attractive because we have evidence that these participants are high-end consumers of workhouse and jail time, multiple arrests. So there's other public entities besides the state that I would suggest will see value in this.
Representative Coles, I hate to do this to you, but we're running low on time, so I'm going to call on Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman.
Appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Representative Paymar, welcome to the committee. And either to you or the witnesses, this is a serious question, even though it may not sound serious. I'm trying to understand, this is a demonstration project, and I heard descriptive phrases such as, well, the cost will go down to $12,000. So it sounds like a learning experience in this demonstration project. Have you as the author or you gentlemen looked at any of the other 49 states or any other legal jurisdictions in the United States system? Has anybody else had a reentry program that of any kind? Or have one of any kind?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Thomas?
Representative Smith, yes, we have made site visits to at least four communities around the country. And that's actually, as Mr. King mentioned, we spent the last year surveying the country. Now, they may not always have the label of reentry, but it's this high-risk population. In Portland, Oregon, for instance, they call them frequent users. They're frequent arrests on the streets, chronic misdemeanors. But also in Multnomah County, they are taking high-risk parolees. And
Mr. Chairman, I don't need a description. I'm trying to understand. So there are other states, and again, I apologize for interrupting, but I'm trying to get to some information, maybe even a point. There are other states that have had these kinds of programs and or some kind of reentry program for a while. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair?
Yep. Mr. Smith?
Mr. Thomas. Representative Smith, yes.
Mr. Chairman, so what part of your administering, so are you looking at those programs to find out what works and what doesn't so you don't have to reinvent the wheel?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Thomas.
Representative Smith, yes. Yes, and that's, in fact, we were just out in New York 2 weeks ago looking at the jobs enterprise piece, and to your very point, they're doing great, but there's some mistakes they made that we don't want to repeat. And we're also looking how could they do better, and we think we've incorporated some of the missing pieces in these programs around the country into our model and expect to have even better performance than what they've been having.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Smith,
one last question. This will call for you to speculate, I suppose, but on either end of the spectrum. We've just had a previous bill that I think if you do the math and 70 people being serviced for that amount of money, where it approaches in that reentry program the cost of incarcerating someone around 29 grand. You've spoken in numbers of maybe getting down to 12,000 at some point. In all of the movies I've seen with Jimmy Cagney in the 1930s, their reentry program was a new suit and $10. So somewhere between a new suit and $10 and the cost to keep them in prison, where will the money go to for the taxpayer in the enlightened society's approach at reentry? How many bucks per year?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. King?
Mrs. Smith, Representative Smith, without getting into the detail around the dollars, I think one of the major issues that's being overlooked here is the fact that the prison system has its own culture that does not readily equip people. And I'm now talking about the guys I deal with every day to reenter our community. I'm a former Army officer. I've spent my entire life training men. And what it does not do and what the community does not have is a culture for these men to come back into. They go back to the same people who helped them with their last caper. What we do here is create a culture, both in training and in housing, a community where they are surrounded by other people who are trying to move their lives. There are high standards and there is support in place for them to make the move. Because it's like stepping out on a banana peel. The guy doesn't have a job in a week. He doesn't have adequate training. He doesn't have adequate housing. He is coming back. So while $19,000 or $12,000 might sound like a lot of money, yes, he's coming back for another $30,000 when he comes back to the system. And we know that to be the case over and over again. It has a painful impact on the community that I live in and work in every day. And when I look at my employers who need people to come and help their businesses grow stronger, we have an alternative. We can invest the $12,000 or $19,000 in making sure that these guys join this working culture, or, as you know from your work here on this committee, we can continue to invest the $30,000 when they go back to jail. So when I view this and we sign on board, and as a small nonprofit put $30,000 in the middle to help kick it off, it seemed like a worthwhile investment for me to put up $30,000 so a guy can go from $6,200 to $25,000 in the first year and up to $55,000 to $60,000 if he can stay in a union job. I would please advise you to come out, take a look, meet some of our people, meet some of the providers who are at the table, look at their track records and what they've been doing. We all do our businesses very well. What's been missing is this coordination that brings us together. And it's been very tough work to sit down with other people over the course of a year and learn to do something new like this. And I feel very strongly about it. We're not benefiting from this financially. What Summit will get is the satisfaction knowing that the guy did not go back to jail because he did not have an adequate culture of support in his life to take that next step. Thank you, sir.
Not to be disrespectful, but we've got two other bills left. I've got witnesses from out of town and one I have. And Representative Dominguez has a short question with a short answer.
I think Dr. Lewis kind of summed it up talking about the incarceration of individuals that do come to the my district, Representative Smith, which is 58B. And to answer your question as far as models throughout the state, I think that Minnesota needs to be a model about our folks coming out of prisons. We have been a model city, and I think we continue to be a model city. I think being a model city also comes with money from national money that comes from the President of the United States to look at what is going on throughout our state. But again, Dr. Lewis, I'm glad that you spoke on behalf of and where these prisoners are going, because it is the north side of Minneapolis. And we're doing a fine job, I do believe, of trying to develop some ways that these folks won't really offend. Excuse me. So with that, I'm going to leave it as it is, because I think you summed it up quite well. Come on out and take a look. Walk those streets over on the north side of Minneapolis and to see what we're talking about. And that's why I think it's very important that we do something that's going to help the community at large.
Representative Eastland, last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a comment rather than a question. I think it's, we like to scrutinize things and appreciate the questions, that we've had about the cost. But even the $30,000 number, if you've been on this committee a while, you realize that that's really not the number. How many million did we bond for last year in building new prisons, and how much money are we spending when we lease prison space? So we actually happen to include the capital costs as well. This is a pretty small amount of money looking at a pretty big issue that could pay some big dividends. And I guess I just compliment these guys for taking on this project. This is a tough thing to take on, and especially take it on the way you guys are approaching it. And I just compliment you for that. And I think this is something that's really worth looking at and making a small investment to see if it could give us some big returns.
This bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And Representative Paymar will proceed to House File 684. I'm going to have to cut you down on time on this one, I'm afraid, to about 15.
Mr. Chair, we only need maybe 5 minutes unless there are questions. Most of you have heard the bill. Most of you understand the problem. House File 684 is a response to what happened in 2003 when the governor and the state legislature basically recommended that short-term offenders serving sentences of less than 6 months be housed in our county jails rather than DOC facilities. It saved the state a significant amount of money, $8.79 million in fiscal year 04 and 05, and $10 million in 06 and 07. Unfortunately, the unintended consequence of that is that it's costed our county. The cost has been borne by our counties. The governor has made a slight adjustment in this, recommending that the reimbursement to counties be $30. This bill would bring it back up to what I think is the average per diem is $55 per month. And with me today is Mr. Carlson to just take a few minutes and talk about the impact on the county.
Before calling on Mr. Carlson, Representative Paymar, you did move to possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association that consists of 13 of the state's larger counties. I want to thank Representative Paymar for pushing forward this bill. It does address significant concern of counties, first because of its financial impact, and then has importantly more so because of the practical impact that short-term offenders have had in the county since 2003. The beds that we are using to house these offenders are beds that we do not have available to serve those prisoners that are our own responsibilities. And as a result, many of our counties that are experiencing the same shortages in beds that the Department of Corrections are currently are forced to lease beds at other facilities and transport their prisoners as far as 100 miles or even more because of the shortages that have been exacerbated by the short-term offenders. That, again, obviously costs us money, but it also takes deputies off the street from duties that they are rarely expected by the public to be serving currently and are not because of the burdens that the short-term offenders are placing on us. So we would be very grateful if the committee and ultimately the legislature will pass legislation along these lines and help us out with the cost and the practical impact. With that, I'll conclude my testimony and be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions? I'll make a quick comment that this bill is near and dear to my heart because it is something that is badly needed in the local counties. Mr. Haas.
I wanted to resonate that. Echoing that one across the table.
Representative Coles has a
real briefly, Representative Paymar, when you were discussing the bill, you talked about the average per diem being, you believe, $55 a day. The bill provides for funding up to $70 per day. Are you saying that the appropriation would get us to $55 a day, but we're allowing some flexibility if per diems at Ramsey County or Hennepin County might be higher than those in Pennington County or other parts of the state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, that's the way the bill is crafted. As I think you maybe heard testimony like in Ramsey County, and you had a bill. I wasn't able to listen to it, and I hope it passes so we can understand the per diem rates vis-a-vis how counties do it differently. But in Ramsey County, I think charge is $95 a day. So I think this was the average. Was Mr. Carger maybe can help out. The average is $55 a day, but the $70 ceiling was the not to exceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Chair.
That's all I have, Mr. Chair.
And we will lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Well, Representative Haas has one last comment.
Just a last comment that ties on to that so people know what's going on in the total package. I also had a hearing for a companion, like a companion bill, complementary bill of 492 for the per diem and a study to be going on at the same time. I do have consensus, and that study will be going on, but the bill is not necessary. And my apologies to the testifiers that I had lined up, but my lips weren't aggressive enough, and other people's ears were too aggressive, so we had some miscommunication. But nevertheless, my bill is not necessary, and we have commitments in the Department of Corrections that is going to happen. And again, my apologies to the testifiers that were lined up. Thank you very much.
Representative Olin, you have House File 2133.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will move for that House File 2133 be possibly included in the omnibus bill.
Very good.
And I will begin with a few comments on this bill. First off, I'll give you the background as to how this bill came about. When Mr. Bergstrom was in my office with some judicial corrections on that one bill that we all saw a while ago, and I believe it was policy, there was a Section 4 that was deleted from his bill. This bill that I have here is what he was going to delete. What happened is in the year 1999, which was about 7 years ago, funding was given to a pre-commitment detention of persons that are under the criminal psychopathic personality statute. But if you read the bill, 253B.185 subdivision 5, that is an ongoing funding bill that specifically says that the state and the counties shall jointly share funding at 50% per year. With the court administrator's office to be billed by the county auditor for their share of the 50%. So what brought Bergstrom's bill around originally was to get rid of it because the court administrator's offices were getting mad at getting those four bills with absolutely no money to pay the bills. And they were thinking, well, why is the counties billing us? Well, the counties were billing them because the statute says they're supposed to bill them. But unfortunately, from the years 1999 to present, there has been no money paid by the state for this program that clearly reads, Representative Eastland, can you find it? Because otherwise I do have a copy. I have a copy here if you want to look at my... you find the book, because otherwise you could use my copy. He couldn't find it. I did have a copy of the statute. I printed it. So.
Oh, yes, then I'll find it.
But anyway, essentially, that's why I brought this motion. You'll see the one handout that you were given today, and I hope, and I forgot to bring it over here when I came, has 4 years showing amounts. I did not ask for a fiscal note before anybody asked me whether I have or haven't. I haven't. But that 4 years would be the total bill to the counties that the counties have paid. So if you looked at that 4 years and you took half of that, that would be about what the state should be paying in 2008 and 2009. Now, I'll let my two witnesses explain better before I get to a couple comments on that, because there is, I believe, something that may straighten out that situation going on, but it won't happen immediately.
Sir, do you want to introduce yourself for the record, please?
Mr. Chair, and committee members, my name is Jim Behrens, and I am the Associate Director for Community Services in Olmsted County. And I'm here to testify on behalf of the Association of Minnesota Counties and Minnesota Association of County Social Services Administrators, which represents all 87 counties in Minnesota. We are in support of House File 2133 and urge you to support inclusion of that bill in the final omnibus appropriations bill. Reducing counties' hold order costs for persons undergoing commitment as sexually dangerous persons is one of our association's top legislative priorities this session because of the significant impact it has on county budgets and our inability to control those increasing costs. Courts in Minnesota use the hold order as a pre-commitment detention mechanism while professionals involved with this process gather data, provide appropriate evaluations, and provide that information to the courts for this very important civil decision. This creates a problem for counties because, as you are aware, the Drew Shadeen case raised significant public issues in Minnesota, and as a result of those public safety concerns, the Department of Corrections began to more closely scrutinize individuals who were due to be released from prison after completing their sentences for sex offenses in Minnesota. The result of this scrutiny increased numbers of these individuals that were referred to county attorney's offices for further evaluation as to their appropriateness for commitment as sex offenders. Again, the significant impact on the counties is related to the handout that you have in your packet that indicates that since fiscal year 2003, those costs have increased for the counties by double each year in all 4 years up to fiscal year 2006. Beginning with 2003, those costs averaged a little bit under $500,000, and this past fiscal year have exceeded $4 million. Even in the best case scenario, these costs are very unpredictable for the counties. In some cases, we do get lead information from the Department of Corrections as to the release dates for individuals and potential referral. But when I'm involved in the beginning processes of budgeting for the ensuing year, I'm trying to look out about 18 to 20 months for people that are due to be released from corrections to determine whether or not they may be referred for potential civil commitment. And then if we even do know the numbers that are due to be released, those individuals that would eventually have a petition filed for commitment is even more difficult to predict because we don't have the records at that point that would allow us to make that initial decision. And also, since the commitment process in Minnesota is part of the mental health process, these actual processes occur in most counties in the mental health services area, and those costs continue to place some jeopardy on the mental health resources that we have in order to fund this public safety issue. In closing, I'd like to say House File 2133 would provide one-time appropriations to the state court administrators, allowing counties to invoice the state for that 50% that's already in statute, and would simply allow, again, the one-time appropriation so that the Department of Corrections and the Department of Human Services can continue to try to work out a longer-term solution to this public safety issue. Lastly, I would say that the appropriation would assist the counties to fund this very important public safety endeavor. We are committed to that public safety, but simply want to share that responsibility at the state level so that statewide safety is also taken into consideration. Thank you for your opportunity to testify, and I'll answer any questions that I'm able.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Olin?
I'll make one quick comment. Ann Lerner is here too, but she doesn't need to testify, but she has indicated that the Department of Human Services and DOC are presently trying to figure out an arrangement that will eliminate the situation permanently. And I would like to comment, and Commissioner Benson, I don't believe, is in the room anymore, that in a case involving Pennington County recently, I did notice at the beginning of last year that they gave me a year's lead time on a sex offender that would be a three rating, which would be one that would more than likely need one of these evaluations done. So Pennington County has been able, I think, to get almost all the evaluations done before his prison term actually expired. what's been happening prior to this time, we haven't gotten this kind of notice, and the prison terms have expired, and lo and behold, we have to put this person in St. Peter to hold him at the county or state's cost. The system is getting better, so I don't know that the number of 2 million will stay that high in the future, and hopefully it won't. But that's where we're at the last year, 4 million and some dollars.
Representative Olin, Mr. Carger was showing me that the state did pay $300,000 in the 2001 biennium to reimburse counties. But I'm trying to, and we haven't paid since, apparently.
Then you did make one payment beyond what I thought it was, because I knew there was a 99.
Representative Olin, I guess the question I have is you testified that DHS and DOC are trying to work something out. You have a blank appropriation on your bill. What are they trying to work out, and what do you think we need to make counties whole?
I'll let Ann come up and address that.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Kate Lerner, and I am the director of MACSA, the statewide association that Mr. Behrens is here to represent as well. I can answer briefly some of your question, but I do know that there is a representative from the Department of Human Services here who may be able to give even more details than I. But I do understand that they are looking at a longer-term solution that essentially would address some of the contributing factors to the increase in costs on these hold orders. And there are a number of factors that do contribute to these increased costs. And their solution is essentially looking at ways to remedy those factors on a more long-term basis, rather than our one-time appropriation, which is a short-term solution. So if there are more details that you'd like, I would suggest we turn it over to one of the representatives from the department.
Now, I would thank you for your testimony. I'd like to hear from the department. Sir, please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mike Tessner. I'm the Chief Executive for State Operated Services, operating within the Department of Human Services. We operate the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. What Ms. Lerner was referring to was that one of the basic factors that contributes to the court hold costs is the timely processing of civil commitments. The Department of Corrections is required in statute to make the referral of offenders who should be considered for civil commitment a year in advance. The majority of folks coming out of the Department of Corrections, that is in fact the case. What we have found is there seems to be a slowdown or a perhaps not intended, but not a timely processing of that civil commitment by the attorneys that are prosecuting the case. So what ends up happening is, frankly, the petition gets filed right before the release date for the offender, and therein the only way to hold them is to put a court hold on them while the civil commitment gets prosecuted. So what we're examining is ways to, if you will, speed up or make the processing of that civil commitment action more efficient so that the individuals in corrections who get referred in that 12 months or more prior to their end of confinement, that process can actually take place and avoid a situation where the court hold costs exist.
So speeding up the process, and when do you envision this this change to take place?
I'm sorry I don't have a date, Mr. Chair, this morning, but we're in conversations now on this process with the county attorneys and the Attorney General's office, who is are the primary people who prosecute the cases.
Well, Representative Olin, what would be your desire with your bill then? Again, you'd have a blank appropriation. Just trying to think realistically what we can do, if anything, this legislative session.
If I had a realistic number, I would put I'd love to see the 2 million put, which appears to be what, based on 06, is going to be, or would be the continuing for each of those 2 years, and then hopefully it'll go away. If you put any lesser number, then I'm assuming what we'd have to do is figure out some prorated system where each county got a fair share of the percent of the bill that they did have, and they'd probably have to get their money all at the end of the year if it didn't cover everything. In an ideal world, you get 2 million, but I'm not going to be realistic enough, knowing the financial situation we're in, to think, but that's going to happen.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Olin, you kind of touched on a question that I had, which is, but I want to make it a little bit more explicit. How are you intending that these funds be distributed to counties? Would it be in proportion to the county's share of costs in the total, or what would you be doing there?
Representative Olin.
Representative Liebling. In an ideal world, we'd be at 100% and just bill the court administrator's office to get paid. Otherwise, the system that I see, which would make the most sense, would be to everybody bills the court administrator's office, and then at the end of the year, they get all these bills, and they put them together, and they prorate it at the end of, well, I imagine fiscal year is going to be the middle, at June 30 next year. They'll prorate it, put it all together, and send out the counties a check for what their percent would have been. So everybody's treated dead even. Instead of first come, first serve, if I've got a guy that goes into this procedure tomorrow morning and I get my money and then somebody else, like Roseau County or Hennepin County, gets one in month 10 and the money's gone, that's hardly a fair system. So in an ideal world, we'd prorate it at the end of the year if we didn't have complete funding.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Owen, I mean, I agree with your bill. I've been around and around with my county people about this bill because of one of the things that's in the statute. It does say that the state is required to pay 50%, but it leaves a exception in there and simply says that only they're only held to that requirement if they allocate the funding for that purpose. And that little section is two lines. It's section D under subdivision 5. You know, maybe at some point in time, a cleaner way to deal with this would just be to delete that little section of law.
Okay, are there any other questions? Then, well, Mr. Tessner, are you going to report, can you report back to this committee on the time frame for you to expedite these matters? Can you let us know? It's a little hard to plan for the future if we don't know what your plans are.
Mr. Chair, I would be happy to.
Thank you. Anything else, Representative Ola?
No, thank you.
Okay, then we will lay House File 2133 on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. If there are no other business before the committee, we are adjourned.